Hi, and welcome to another edition of Visions with me, Yudalee Wickham-Ashby. And as we enter another week, enter another day, we think of all the challenges that are confronting us. We have the COVID-19 pandemic, the La Soufre volcano eruptions, and so many disruptions to our lives. Today, I want us to take a focus on the COVID-19 as it specifically relates to persons with disability. And I have invited Dr. Russell Broom Webster to just share his thoughts about the COVID-19 pandemic and its impact on persons with disabilities. Dr. Russell is with the Barbados Association of Medical Practitioners and a medical doctor. So I now invite Dr. Russell Broom Webster to just briefly introduce himself and talk to us about COVID-19 and some of its ramifications for people with disabilities. Dr. Webster?
Hi, good morning. Yudalee, thank you for inviting me to the show. I first just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Russell Broom Webster. I'm a family physician. I am the public relations officer for the Barbados Association of Medical Practitioners. I also am the lead physician for the transitional care program at the QEH. And I just have a general interest in public health and infectious disease. I guess everyone does right now with everything else that's going on. I wanted to talk briefly today a bit about COVID-19 and highlight some specific issues as it relates to persons living with disabilities. I think that is a very important and timely conversation. It, as with most situations that relate to people that are differently abled or that are living with disabilities, they can sometimes get lost in all of the noise that is happening in wider society. And it's something that we have to be conscious of. They are an important group that contributes significantly to our society, and we need to pay special attention to these persons. I myself know many people within my family structure and extended family who are within this group, and it's something that is very, very close to me. Before I move on any further, it would be remiss of me not to say a special word anytime I'm talking about COVID-19 to all those persons who have made significant sacrifice over the last year. I think Barbados's first case was on March 18th. We've passed that now in terms of our anniversary, and it may be something that we have to deal with in public health for some time. So to all the frontline workers, many of my colleagues working in the medical field, but to everyone who's participating and every day to make Barbados a safer Barbados, I want to send kudos to you and just some encouraging words that everyone appreciates your efforts. On top of that, also the persons who've been dealing with it from the other end, try to stay positive, keep your mental health where it needs to be, because right now, especially with the recent volcanic eruption, we have so much more to think about on a daily basis, and it's something that we really need to be conscious of. So without further ado, I will just talk a little bit about COVID-19. So with reference to COVID-19, we know that that term means coronavirus disease, and the 19 stands for 2019. In late 2019, there was a cluster of respiratory infections which was causing severe illness in the city of Wuhan in Hubei, China. Once that was notified through their various surveillance systems, people recognized that this was a new virus. It was sequenced. It continued to spread, and the World Health Organization on January 30th, 2020, declared coronavirus 19 a public health emergency of international concern, which is their highest level of alert. At that time, I think it was still something very intangible for most of us, watching on the news, seeing it happen. But we all watched as it took hold and spread over the entire globe. As it stands today, we currently have, when I look at the dashboard, I can't even believe it when I look at it, there are about 137, just over 137 million confirmed cases, almost 3 million deaths. And in Barbados specifically, we've now had about 3,740 cases with 44 total deaths and 6 cases as of yesterday. As you know, we vaccinated about 65,000 people in total. And that vaccination process, due to the recent eruption, has been temporarily suspended until we're in a position to begin in earnest again with the second doses. Globally, about 800 million vaccine doses have been administered, about 20 million per day. And that's been done across 152 countries. So even though that only accounts for a very small percentage of the global population, we know that this is all happening in real time. And all of these, you know, this is a really important topic for everyone right now. With reference to COVID-19, I'll just touch on a few broad areas so that we can all be on the same page, because information that is for everybody is certainly for the disabled community as well. And it just needs to be, we just need to make sure that everyone has access and all this information is distilled. Now, coronavirus 19 or COVID-19 disease is the name of the disease. The virus itself is called SARS-CoV-2, and that virus is what causes coronavirus. Now, ultimately, once you are exposed to the viral particles, meaning someone may have been talking close to you, or they coughed or sneezed, or in an environment close to you, there's a potential, if you weren't wearing a mask, if you weren't socially distanced, that you could be infected with the virus. And that stands true for everyone. Once that happens, this virus then infects the cells, and it can cause a wide range of symptoms, which can be respiratory related, meaning, you know, you can have very mild symptoms from a sniffle to, you know, a mild sore throat. You may have some dry cough or some coughing. And as that virus makes its way down your respiratory tract, you can think of it that way. As it comes through the mouth, you may have some, you know, symptoms at the front, there by the nose and mouth. But as it progresses and really starts to replicate in what we call in the lungs, you can then get much more severe illness, where persons may develop a pneumonia and can even move on to developing respiratory failure, which may require ventilation and possibly even death. So that's kind of the clinical course. In most people, they will develop symptoms about 4 to 5 days after being exposed, and about 80% of persons that are infected will have mild disease, with about 13% or so requiring hospitalization, and about 5% or so actually needing intensive care. So, you know, we know that this disease can cause a wide range of presentations, and that's why it's such an ominous disease, because persons can also be asymptomatic as well. And a large majority, well, not a large majority, but a wide range of persons can have asymptomatic disease. And I think those estimates can range from, you know, 25% to 50% of all infections. So importantly, people can still transmit the virus when they're asymptomatic, which is a really important point that we always need to remember as well. Now, with reference to the treatment of the treatment of this particular disease, is important to remember that a lot of the treatment that's been, you know, discussed so far is supportive. And what that means is that if you do get sick, you then have an opportunity, we have an opportunity to support you if you do develop more severe disease. So for persons who require hospitalization, that usually will include monitoring, using, you know, checking your oxygen levels, doing some blood tests, also giving oxygen if your oxygen levels are low. In some cases, some other drugs may be used if you become really severe. And in the very severe cases, persons may need to be placed on mechanical ventilation. So that's important to understand because you have a range of disease. And I think sometimes because there's a discussion about some people being asymptomatic, that there can be a level of, some people can feel a bit more relaxed because they say, well, you know, a lot of people may not get sick. But the reality is that even if you are asymptomatic, you can transmit to someone who may be vulnerable, and that person can then become very ill. And it's that kind of humanitarian effort that's necessary for everyone to understand the whole pathway of this disease, from asymptomatic infection to transmission to severe disease and death, and how close a society like ours, which has so many people living with various risk factors, how important it is that we all participate in the process for prevention and understand what's happening with COVID-19. So importantly, as I mentioned just now, there are certain conditions, underlying medical conditions, which individuals may have, which put them at an increased risk of developing severe COVID-19 if they are infected. So to be clear, this doesn't mean that because you have, this doesn't mean that you're more susceptible to infection, meaning that if you were exposed because you had one of these conditions, you would get infected much easier than another person. What this means is that if you do become infected, that there is a higher risk of you developing a more severe disease course, meaning that in many people, they may begin to resolve around day six or seven after developing symptoms. You know, your disease may then get worse at that time, and you start to develop more severe disease. And, you know, generally speaking, I won't list all of the conditions, but these are NCD-related complications. So persons who have cancer, people who have significant heart disease, such as heart failure, persons living with diabetes in particular, some studies suggest hypertension as well, people living with cancer. Now, importantly, as this relates to the disabled community, it's important to understand that disability by itself may not make you a higher risk for contracting coronavirus disease or developing a more severe disease course. However, we know that persons with disabilities have a much higher rate of NCDs in general. Persons who live with disabilities sometimes have disabilities which may predispose them to getting infected much easier. For example, if they are not able to follow the guidelines, the various preventative guidelines easily because of some disability, then that person certainly would be at a higher risk than the average person who can understand and carry out the relevant instructions with reference to public health preventative measures. So it's a nuanced situation, but we need to look carefully at the individuals within this group that are certainly at increased risk, not only for infection, but for being exposed for having severe disease, which all relies on a lot of the basic principles that I would have already discussed about those underlying medical conditions, which I'm sure some persons will ask questions about. So now, with reference to another important group of disabled persons, if similar to the elderly, if you have a primary support giver or a primary caregiver who you need, who you depend on, that puts you at a slightly higher risk, because it means that persons are constantly coming in to your home, or an individual may need to come into your home or come into your personal space on a regular basis in order to deliver care or to support your day-to-day activities. And that means that, you know, you could be put at an increased risk because of that interaction, unlike other persons who may just be able to stay in their bubble, stay at home, and follow those public health recommendations. So now, outside of all of that discussion around transmission and clinical disease course, we then come to, and then talking a little bit about treatment, persons always ask, is there any other treatment besides the supportive care that's offered for persons with COVID-19? And the reality is that there are some drugs available now which do show benefit. The availability of those drugs and accessibility is different in different areas, and sometimes the recommendations may differ. But drugs that that most people have heard about are antiviral agents. There may be drugs that cause immunosuppression, meaning that they tend to decrease the immune response, because when COVID gets to a very severe state, the majority of the problems that it causes are due to inflammation. So that's why drugs like steroids, particularly dexamethasone, as well as some immune monoclonal antibodies that affect the immune system, tocilizumab and sarilumab, these drugs can work well to help in those very severe patients. Now, there are many drugs that have been tested for COVID-19, many that are in the press. Notable ones would be hydroxychloroquine as well as ivermectin, which is the newest hot drug, vitamin D as well. And those drugs so far have not proven any benefit for the treatment of coronavirus disease. Newer agents, such as the cocktail that President Trump got, called Regeneron, is showing some good evidence that those work. But again, many of those drugs would not be widely accessible because of cost. Now, outside of the treatment, then we can then talk a little bit about prevention, which is probably the most important cornerstone of managing this entire pandemic. And there are lots of personal things that we can do. There are lots of community or national things that we can do to help. And again, I just want to stress that it needs public buy-in. It needs a collective effort for all of this to make a difference, from policymakers all the way down to individuals living at home with their respective families. And the mainstays of prevention that people talk about all the time, we talk about, you would hear persons talking about non-pharmaceutical interventions, which is the same thing as preventative public health measures. And really, that those all come back down to, how does this virus transmit between people? And what are the things that we can do in terms of infection, prevention, and control to stop the virus from transmitting from person to person? And the first thing is to physically distance. Now, this is probably the most important thing, but not always a practical thing to do in terms of getting back to life. And this can go from being as extreme as locking down, to locking down a country completely, to having, you know, as you see in some of our neighboring countries, protocols and physical distancing regulations in offices and in restaurants and those kinds of things. But it's important. However, one of the other issues with COVID-19 is that we know that when this virus transmits, which I didn't mention in detail earlier, that it can be aerosolized. And therefore, it means that, you know, the distancing recommendations have their limitations, depending on the duration of time you may be in a room with someone, the ventilation in that particular room, how regular it, you know, the air is changed, and how high the ceilings are, and what kind of filtration systems exist. These things make a huge difference, because if you're in a small box and everyone is talking and shouting and partying, then we would get what we call as a super spreader event because of the aerosolized particles infecting everyone in a small space. And you know, that's really important. So the other important factor, if that's happening or you can't physically distance, well, to add to that, then we talk about wearing a mask. And wearing a mask is probably one of the, you know, that was a controversial topic initially. It became standardized. Many places now have mandatory mask wearing policies. But we know that this can be challenging, particularly for some groups. And as I mentioned earlier, it's a big challenge for some people who live in the disabled community. So we need to take that into consideration. However, we shouldn't forget it. And caregivers, everyone who is supporting an individual that may have challenges, they all need to wear their mask, wear it appropriately. There is some recommendation, particularly recently from the CDC research, that says double masking is better. And it's important to wear your mask correctly. So while physical distance, we say generally about 6 feet apart, for masking, we want persons to make sure to wear a mask that fits securely over their nose and their mouth. A cloth mask with an appropriate filtration system is preferable for the general public. But also, if there is easy availability, you can use a medical grade mask, so a surgical mask, or as has become more available in Barbados recently, a KN95 grade mask. And in the context of the volcanic eruption, these things are also very, very important as well. So you can kill two birds with one stone for your respiratory health. And the other thing would be hygiene practices. So respiratory hygiene is important. If you need to cough, sneeze, do it, you know, in the corner of your elbow, do it in a tissue, dispose of that easily, wash your hands regularly, clean surfaces. This general hygiene is extremely good for disease in general. And again, very applicable with reference to what's happening with the volcano. So we can again kill two birds with one stone. And the last layer really of protection would be vaccinations. So with reference to vaccines, we know that this is obviously a topic that is very concerning for most people. There's been so much politicization, a lot of hypersensitivity around the topic, because I think people generally are, you know, distressed, tired, mentally fatigued with the entire pandemic, and the attention on vaccines is that, well, maybe this may be a way out. The first thing I would like to say is that vaccines can work, but they can work in conjunction with all the other public health measures. And you know, they're a really important tool to make sure that we control the morbidity, meaning how sick people get, and the mortality, how many people die associated with COVID-19, which is pretty high. As I had discussed earlier, over almost 3 million people now have died globally from this disease. And many more have been sick in hospital. And the other important thing is that many people will continue to be sick for a long time. As we now realize that COVID has a syndrome, which people may call, you may hear people use the term long haulers, long COVID, post-acute COVID syndrome. But that just means that after recovering from COVID, people have lingering symptoms for a long period of time. Now, with reference to the vaccine is encouraged for almost everyone, especially in the adult age group, which is over the age of 18. Some countries, those vaccines can be used in persons up to the age of, from the age of 16. And, you know, I think a general misconception is that somehow a medication you're taking or an underlying condition may not, you know, permit you to use the vaccine. But the reality is that the vaccine is actually recommended for almost for most people, okay, with most issues, because if it wasn't, then we would be in a very difficult situation, as those persons, if they do become infected, have a much more, have a higher chance of developing severe illness. And those are the people that we want to protect, in particular our elderly population as well. So once you have an opportunity to access the vaccine, that would be generally my recommendation to everyone. And obviously accessing it depends on availability in country, as well as whether you actually have an appointment and all the other various things, which I'm sure we could have a conversation about, especially with reference to the disabled community. But importantly, the vaccines are safe. I think that's something that, and effective. What that means is that they achieve what they're supposed to do. So when we do these large trials for vaccines, which all of these vaccines, there are about five or six of them that have now been approved, we look specifically to see how the vaccine reacts in individuals. So we do small trials to see what side effects they have. Then we move on to, once that is relatively safe, we move on to larger trials to see how the body responds to the vaccine, meaning how your immune system responds. Do you actually mount a significant immune response? And then we will move on to look and see how this works in a large population.
So
yeah, I think I can stop there for now.
Right.
And we'll take any questions.
Your questions?
Yeah.
So do we have any questions? Well, I will start the ball rolling, because as you pointed out, in terms of the vaccine, quite a few people have concerns, and you're seeking to allay those concerns by pointing out that the vaccine is safe to use. But in light of what we're hearing, that so many, well, it may seem like a lot to us, but to the scientists and medical profession, it's like a small number, like 1 in 1 million that have developed blood clots. What are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is probably the hottest topic right now. As with COVID-19, there's always a hot topic. There was masks, and you know, when we were at the prevention stage, then there's hydroxychloroquine, and now we're at the stage where we're starting to now evaluate closely some of the longer term, well, not really long term, but maybe some of the short term rare side effects that potentially could happen with vaccines. I think the underlying message that people need to take away is that because of the nature of the entire rollout, which is we had an emergency use authorization for all these vaccines. Trials were done as comprehensively as they could be to make sure that the impact on people was minimized. But we are constantly monitoring. And I think this should encourage most persons who hear about any reports at all, whether it's related to blood clots, whether it's related to Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a common neurological condition sometimes that can happen with vaccines, whether it's related to someone just describing what happened to them. We want to hear what the issues are that the public may be having when they take the vaccine, because we want to know, is this vaccine working well in our population? So far, it seems to be the case based on the reports that we've seen in Barbados. And is this vaccine importantly working appropriately? So we have this concern about cerebral venous sinus thrombosis, which is a rare blood clot that can happen in a particular area of the brain. And that's where all of the conversation is about right now. Essentially, the important thing to remember is that in order to say that a vaccine causes a particular problem, there's a lot of research and investigation that has to go on. And that's why all these committees, you may see them pausing from time to time, or stopping, or you know, looking to see what's going on, because they really want to make sure that if it is happening, what has actually happened, to give the public confidence and to move on. So, I think that's generally speaking, but it's a very rare event so far. And what we need to do is make sure that we monitor what's happening locally, encourage persons to report, and to give some, and we will constantly give feedback as the medical practitioners to the public as to what's happening. But so far, we haven't had any issues like that, and hopefully we don't have any.
Thank you very much, Dr. Russell. And we will have to take a wrap here. So it has been pretty informative, and I want to say thank you, and thank you to the audience who have taken the time to listen and interact. You have been listening to Visions with me, Yodali Wickham-Ashby, and today we had a very good conversation with Dr. Russell Broome-Webster on the whole subject of COVID-19 as it relates to persons with disabilities. Remember, you can reach me on 1-246-269-9660 or via Starcom at 1-246-430-7300, as well as via email visionsbarbados@gmail.com. That is visionsbarbados@gmail.com. And of course, you can listen to this and past episodes of Visions on the VOB929.com website. So until next week, stay safe, love yourself, and be productive.